I am so looking forward to welcoming in our guest for this hour, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. We will talk with him about his new book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And I know you are looking forward to hearing from him as well. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 7.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, March the 26th. But first, we have this important announcement from Wisconsin Public Radio's Rob Ferret. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Joy. It's our spring membership drive. We count on your support to keep programs and discussions like this one on the air each and every day. And here's a little added bonus. If you pledge this hour, $180 or more.
That's a little music to
that was that, just how dramatic this special offer is. If you pledge $180 or more, you can get your very own copy of Neil deGrasse Tyson's new book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. That's what we'll be talking about this hour. You can follow up. There's going to be a lot more in the book than can happen in 1 hour. So you can continue the discussion on your own. Pledge $180 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And your pledge of any amount is very helpful. We appreciate it.
You know, we fell just 5 pledges short of our goal last hour. And thank you so very much. I mean, that's wonderful. It's really wonderful, all of the support that you're giving Wisconsin Public Radio. But we have a new goal during this hour. We have a goal of 45 pledges. So 45 pledges for Wisconsin Public Radio, and pledges that might pick you up a copy of Neil deGrasse Tyson's book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Make that pledge right now. We count on your support for about 40% of our budget here at Wisconsin Public Radio. That's a lot. That's really important. It's not just a little side portion of it. We count on you for your support each and every year. Make that pledge now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, when I posted on Facebook, Rob, that Neil deGrasse Tyson would be joining us today, our listeners were very excited. And here's just a sampling of the dozens and dozens of comments that we received. Chris on Facebook writes, Neil is this generation's Carl Sagan, a tremendously smart guy whose passion is infectious, his personality magnetic, and the ability to inspire so many to really engage in thought. Thank you for all you do, Neil. And just below that comment, Amy says, I agree. He is this generation's Sagan, and America desperately needs people like him. Thank you, Neil, and thank you, Joy, for having him on the show. Dale on Facebook writes, Neil deGrasse Tyson can profoundly inspire scientists. He is a fantastic speaker and educator. And that is just a couple of, as I said, dozens of comments. People love Neil deGrasse Tyson. And if you love the fact that Wisconsin Public Radio is able to bring you guests like Neil deGrasse Tyson and talk about the many important issues and ideas facing us, facing our time, give us a pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It takes just a couple minutes of your time. It's a great way to start the morning supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. You keep these conversations coming to you, and you can pick up your very own copy of Neil deGrasse Tyson's new book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Ask for your own copy when you pledge $180 or more. Make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, let me welcome our guest. Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist. He is director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. He is the author of Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, and he joins us from the Argo Studios in New York. Good morning.
Happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Well, so besides being this generation's Carl Sagan, and there are so many compliments on our Facebook page. Another one.
I think my mother got access to your Facebook page. She wrote all of those for sure.
You know, though, here's another one. I wanted to have you respond to this. Brian on Facebook writes, "Mr. Tyson is a brilliant and wonderful advocate for science. He represents a badly needed voice in the White House." So, would you want to work in the White House?
No, not at all. I have no such aspirations, no such interest. In fact, taking that point to the limit, the New York Times asked me, "What would I do if I were president?" And I have my full response on my website. If you just go to my website and search for president, you'll find it. We live in an elective democracy, and I think it is the job of the electorate to understand the causes and effects of what makes a great economy and a great society and a great culture. And it is their voting power that should then decide this, not the politicians themselves. So to just go to the White House and tell the White House what to do, no, I'm an educator and I'm a scientist, and I think my place is among the people, educating them so that they can vote for whoever it is they want, but in an informed and enlightened way.
Yeah. You certainly would like to see NASA's budget increase, though, don't you?
Oh, yeah. But people have used the word advocate for me as I describe science and space exploration. I'm not comfortable with that word, because that implies I'm going to just beat you on the head and say, we need to do this. And yes, I'm kind of saying that, but without beating you on the head. It's, if we don't do it, here is the consequence. And so you vote, all right? We're collectively a nation who votes, and at least we tell ourselves in our Constitution that we're the ones in charge, not the president. President works for us, all right? So it's up to us to create the mandate that a healthy space program, and the understanding that a healthy space program, in the ways I've described in the book, will create and infuse and sustain a culture of innovation that will drive tomorrow's economies. Mm-hmm. And nobody wants to die poor, all right? We're a capitalist country, and we've all bought into that. And so these are ways to stoke our economy beyond just a space spinoff. It's just if we go into space, then everybody's dreaming about tomorrow. Even the poets and the journalists and comedians and actors. Everybody is a participant, even if you're not a scientist and engineer. And that's what shapes your culture.
Yeah. So what got you dreaming about space?
Well, I'm driven by different motives. But I don't assume everyone likes space in the way that I like space. I like space because I just think it's cool. I think it's cool to look up at night. Not enough people do that. You know, if you come out of the bar late at night, do you look up? Probably not, right? Day and night, any building I walk out of, I look up. And that's no small feat when you grow up in New York City, where looking up, you just see more buildings, right? So you have to sort of align your view to see that slice of sky that makes it through the canyon and the steel and glass canyons that is Manhattan. And I look up and I wonder, you know, what's out there and how did it get there and what is its history and what is its future? And so I'm attracted by the discovery, by the act of discovering the cosmos. And so is a subset of the population. These are the folks who relished in every next image that came back from the Hubble telescope, for example. And, you know, how many of us had Hubble images as screensavers on our computers? I mean, it's essentially everybody, mm-hmm. right? And what the great thing about Hubble and those images is that they were so beautiful, so stunning, that they did not even require a caption for you to bask in all that they could mean to you. And I don't know any other scientific data that you could embrace in this way without a caption. And so there are people who do love the universe. But that's not who I'm addressing primarily in the book. I'm addressing people who have always questioned why we should ever go into space and didn't see its need or value. And I'm simply saying that its value is not just keeping scientists and engineers happy. It's fundamental to the identity of nations, and it'll decide who leads the world economically going into the future.
Yeah, I do want to talk more about that, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about your personal story. I read that you wanted to be an astrophysicist when you were like 10, 12 years old.
Yeah, 11. Yeah, 11.
My goodness. I mean, not many 11-year-olds are saying that. And what inspired you to do that?
Well, yeah, so my first visit to the Hayden Planetarium, which is my local planetarium in New York, I was 9. It was a family trip, and it was whoa, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, in New York, there is no night sky. As I was saying, it's a dozen stars at night. That's about it. You can see the sun and the moon and a few planets. To go to the planetarium at age 9, and the lights, you know, it's a round room with the hemispherical ceiling, right? It's a weird place, and there's a big bug looking piece of hardware in the middle, and the lights dim, and the stars come out, and I feel like the universe chose me. That I had no say in the matter. And I knew that this was interesting, but it would take a couple of years to realize that it could become a career. So by age 11 and onward, if you were one of those adults that asked that annoying question they always ask, what do you want to be when you grow up? I would say astrophysicist. And then they'd walk away.
What?
That was kind of the end of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, was it? I also read in your book that you share a birthday with NASA, and
the same week. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, it's the same instant, but it's definitely the same week. NASA was born the same week that I was born, mm-hmm. in time and in space, and so I feel a certain irrational kinship to the agency for that reason, and. We've lived together in the same parts of what drove 20th century geopolitics and science, and so like I said, I feel a certain responsibility even to do all I can to shepherd its future.
We are talking about the future of NASA and the future of space exploration. We will welcome your questions as well for Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is author of Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. We will take those questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with Rob Ferret, who has an update for us on our spring membership drive. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Joy. We've gotten our first three pledges toward our goal of 60 this hour. Thanks to those of you who already started us off on the right foot. Now it's your turn. Make a pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And this hour, you can pick up a copy of Neil deGrasse Tyson's Space Chronicles. That's the subject of the discussion this hour. You can pick it up and run with it if you make that pledge. $180 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Jennifer from Madison recently made a pledge. She says, Wisconsin Public Radio is real journalism. It means so much to me. Richard and Sudi from Madison made a pledge because they think Wisconsin Public Radio is terrific and they listen to it all day long. Join the many who have made the commitment to help support Wisconsin Public Radio to bring you discussions like this with Neil deGrasse Tyson. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And with your $180 pledge, ask for his new book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier.
The Ideas Network connects you with experts, and this is a great example. How many times can you just pick up the phone and talk to the editor of a magazine, a politician, or Neil deGrasse Tyson? The Ideas Network brings these experts right to you. To help make it possible, give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Neil deGrasse Tyson, before we go to our calls and Facebook comments, wanted to talk a little bit with you about the theme of this book. You say that if we don't commit to space exploration and to funding NASA properly, what's going to happen?
Well, people look around and say we have problems in the world, there's failing education systems. You know, there's the normal list of ailments that are offered to try to justify spending money, as people would say, on Earth rather than in space. without recognizing that the money in space, in fact, offers us the greatest hope of fundamental solutions to those problems. And for example, I'll give you an example. And the notion that in order to improve the number of science kids in school, the obvious thought is, well, let's improve the science teaching. And so you put some money towards that problem, and then you sort of you wipe your hands. You say, okay, we're done there. But no, because you have some better science teachers and you might ignite some flames, but you got to keep fanning that flame. And when they get out, they need a place to apply their newfound interest, and we got nothing for them. If you what I offer as an example is doubling NASA's budget from the half a penny on the tax dollar that it now is to a penny on the tax dollar. That would be enough to go to Mars in a big way. It would be headline news, you know, weekly about what advances we've achieved to accomplish that. Then kids in school will see this play out in the news, in the general discussions of talk shows and on blogs and everywhere else. And there'll be a force of inspiration that'll reverberate down the educational pipeline like no other force that exists. So people will want to become scientists and engineers because they will see this epic adventure unfolding in a big way. And so that's a force that no one is thinking about when they say, let's just give you a better science teacher. These are forces that are greater than how good or bad your teacher is, because they operate fundamentally as part of the culture. In the 1960s, you had to beat people back from entering the science classroom because there was so much enthusiasm and interest in what being a scientist and engineer could do. And so these are the kinds of forces that a healthy exploration program bring to bear on society.
Well, Brian on Facebook wants to know, can Neil talk about the long-term effects of underfunding NASA as it relates to long-term technology development? Would he agree that contemplating such reductions is penny-wise and pound-foolish?
Yeah, so that's an excellent way to word it. And so there's the opportunity cost, which is very hard for people to carry with them. It's what is the cost of not doing something? Mm-hmm. Because it takes extra thinking to arrive at that understanding than it does to look at the cost of doing something, right? So the cost of not going into space means means we will continue to no longer dream about our future. In the 1960s, what we would call the golden age of space exploration, the Moon Apollo program, we were dreaming about the future. That was the bloodiest, most turbulent decade in American history since the Civil War, right? With assassinations and a hot war in the Southeast Asia, Vietnam, and a Cold War, and campus unrest, and the civil rights movement unfolding weekly, and 100 servicemen a week dying. And people were still dreaming about tomorrow. And they were dreaming about tomorrow, a kind of tomorrow that science and technology would deliver to you. And that's with the entire foundation, the entire dream state that was the New York World Fair of 1964. And when you just add up people's urges to think about creating a tomorrow that was different from today and look at whether that's happening today. No. There are no articles on the city of tomorrow, the home of tomorrow, transportation of tomorrow, the jets of tomorrow, how much faster we'll get to destination. No, that all stopped. And it stopped basically in the mid-1970s when we stopped going to the moon. And so the cost of not dreaming means we've lost the connection between an idea that you might have for what the future would be and the capacity to enable that idea in the present.
On Facebook, Samuel asks, what kinds of new technology do you think will come about with the commercialization of space travel in the near future?
So the commercialization of space travel, there's some misunderstandings there, and I just want to sort of mm-hmm. clarify that here and now. People are thinking that commercial space travel will replace NASA as the leading explorer of space. That's just false. It can't happen. It will never happen. Not because I don't want it to happen that way. It's just the history of commercial participation in adventures. That history is one where it never happens. And there's a good reason for why it doesn't happen. Take space as an example. It's expensive. Advancing a frontier is expensive. There are uncertain risks. There are uncertain costs. And it's dangerous. When you combine all those factors, you can't create a capital market valuation of that exercise. You just can't. If it's free market, it implies that you're going to get an investor and you're going to be able to tell them, thanks for that money, you're going to get this return on that investment in this number of years. You can't do that if you're in the act of doing something that's never been done before and it's expensive. So governments do these sorts of things. And when the government does it, then monies go out, patents are found, the pathways are established. Take the Columbus voyages, for example, paid almost entirely by Queen Isabella. He brings back the maps of where he went and where the winds are that will get him there efficiently and whether the natives where he went are hostile or friendly. This is information that capital markets can then use, and then they follow. So the Dutch East India Trading Company were not the first Europeans to the New World, all right? That would come much later once the risks are established. So what you want to use the private enterprise for is doing the routine things that NASA already knows and understands and can quantify, such as going in and out of low Earth orbit. And that should have happened long ago with private enterprise taking that over. They can do it efficiently and cheaply in all the ways that private enterprise can help society.
Our guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson, author of Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. If you would like to support Wisconsin Public Radio and you would like a copy of his brand new book, Space Chronicles, you can go to WPR.org and pledge $180 to help pay for the programming that you value on Wisconsin Public Radio, or call 888-202-2552. Your pledge of any amount helps pay for the programming. Your pledge of $180 will get you a copy of the book Space Chronicles.
We've got 5 pledges so far toward our goal of 60 pledges this hour. Thanks. If you've pledged already, if not, do it right now. Do it because you support this kind of enlightening and interesting discussion. Pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Let's take a call from Norm in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Norm.
Hi. Dr. Tyson, what an honor to be speaking with you. I have a question about the Kepler satellite, which is our planet-searching satellite. My understanding is that Kepler looks for exoplanets by using the transit method, which is the dimming of the stellar light as the planet passes between its star and us. So in effect, what we're looking for is a very dim shadow cast from very far away. Now, our own stellar body, the sun, experiences a lot of sunspot variations that wax and wane based on solar magnetic fields. So, and we can assume that this happens on all stellar bodies. So my question is, how do the Kepler scientists know that the dimming of the stellar light is from a planet transit and not from the solar spot variation?
And you put your finger right on some of the greatest challenges of these experiments, because there is a lot of sort of false positives, as we'd say in a scientific realm, where there's a signal and you say, oh, that kind of looks like what I'm after, and then it's not. All right. And so, yes, so there are algorithms that help you distinguish whether it's a pack of sunspots crossing the star's disk and whether they're not. So, for example, we have some understanding of how long it takes stars to rotate. So, and you can measure, there's a way to get a measurement of what the rotation rate is of these stars, two ways. If you can't measure it, we have some understanding of the range of what it should be. And in other cases, you can actually measure it. And so if you find this dimming that is right on rhythm with what the rotation of the star is, either the planet is orbiting right on the star's surface, or you've got a pack of sunspots running its course. So this is why, for example, they have 2,000 planet candidates in their catalog right now, but they're only sort of publishing a few at a time once they have enough confidence that the planet candidate is actually a planet. And so the officially sort of accepted number right now, we're rising through 600 or so exoplanets, and Kepler's contributed maybe 100 to that number, but there are many more to come depending on how well the signals can survive the filtering of these other contaminating signals.
Thanks, Norm, for the call. If you have a question for Neil deGrasse Tyson, our call-in number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Tom sent an email. Tom wants to know, how did the universe get to a diameter of 26 billion light years moments after the Big Bang? Wow, I didn't know that.
So it expanded very quickly. There's a period that of expansion that we call inflation, which, by the way, was named at a time when there was great inflation in America. So the word had very high currency. It's an accurate and a very good word, and we might have used the word anyway, but it was certainly around in the late 1970s when there was inflation all around us. Certainly not the case today. So that period expanded essentially faster than the speed of light would have carried the edge of our horizon. And that's okay when space itself is doing the expanding. The speed of light limit is only a constraint of objects moving within the pre-existing space, not in the expansion of the space itself. So the universe can expand at any arbitrary rate at all, whatever the dynamics require of it. But it did not get to this 26 billion light-year diameter size at the beginning. That took 13.7 billion years to reach that size. And it's 13.7 billion years in every direction you look. So you double that and you get the full diameter of our horizon as we view it. So no, it didn't happen immediately, but it happened eventually.
Mm. So what should be
And it's still growing at the rate of one light year per year. Our horizon is growing at one light year per year.
Wow. So what should be the next stop in space exploration?
That's a natural question, because in the 60s we went to the moon, mm-hmm. and then the urge was, well, now let's go to Mars. And I okay, you can have that conversation, but I'd rather step above that conversation and say, you know, I don't care where the next step is. All I care is that we have the capacity to explore space in whatever way and for whatever drives it. So what you do is here's an example of that. You would set up a suite of launch vehicles with strapped-on rockets of various capacities, and then you can say, I'd like to go to the moon today. There you go. Get two rockets from column A and one from column B, strap on a capsule. You're there. Oh, you know, there's an asteroid with our name on it. I might want to stop it. Okay, here is what you need to get to that asteroid. Oh, we still want to find life on Mars. Here is the rocket to get you to Mars. So it recognizes that there could be geopolitical reasons, touristic reasons, possibly other commercial mining reasons. Certainly there's always scientific reasons to go into space. Whatever are those reasons, as long as you're innovating to advance a frontier, it will benefit society at large. And what motivates any of those does not concern me, because the total motivation, the summed motivation of all those activities at the end of the day is to drive the economic health of our nation. And it would definitely have that impact.
Yeah, it also could save us from an asteroid that's going to possibly destroy life as we know it, right?
Yeah, here's the problem there. First, yes. And so if none of these other reasons convince you, not even the fact that it would stoke our economy, how about the fact that you'd want humans to continue as a species on Earth, right? How's that for a reason
to keep a
healthy space program?
And there's one that's coming close I don't remember the year now.
Yeah, well, there's several, and as our detection of them becomes better and better, we will learn more and more mm-hmm. about how close they're actually getting to us. We spent most of the history of human life with no data, right? So we're just ignorant of these buzz cutting asteroids that would whiz by Earth. What makes the next couple very interesting is that they're coming closer to Earth than our orbiting satellites, and that's. You know, duck, right, when these things come. And so here's the problem with asteroids. You want to find out if they're going to intersect Earth early enough so that perhaps if you're going to nudge them out of the way, a small nudge early is as good as a big nudge later. So you want to nudge them early. The problem is, if I nudge it, I say, oh, this asteroid is going to kill us all in 50 years. Well, 88% of Congress has a two-year election cycle, all right? So I don't know that they have the foresight to vote for legislation that'll affect a generation not yet born, or affect those that will be their sort of follow-ons multiple election cycles later. So what has to happen is we need to compel, as a nation, our leaders. Decisions to do this should not be subject to political whims. It should be bigger than the views of the politicians themselves. And when it is, it becomes incumbent upon any one of them to exercise our wishes as a citizenry. And it's not even a matter of a campaign slogan. It's, yeah, of course you're going to do this because you're our president. All right? Are you Republican, Democrat? Irrelevant. You're our president, and this is our mandate as a people, because we don't want the species to die, and we don't want to die poor. All right? So both of these combined should be a national directive and not be left up to the politician to decide whether they think it's the right thing to do.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is our guest. And we have an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. As we are talking with him about the issues and ideas in his book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Also joining me is Rob Ferret, as we have an ultimate frontier, a goal this hour to reach in our spring pledge drive.
That's right. We're looking for 50 more pledges this hour. In the next 20 minutes, we can do it with your help. As an added bonus, when you pledge $180 or more, you get Neil deGrasse Tyson's new book, Space Chronicles. And it's packed with information about space, the case he's been making for supporting space research and travel, and a lot of tweets. Some of them are pretty funny. Space tweet number 66 I'll read now. Isaac Newton, smartest ever. Discovered laws of motion, gravity, and optics. Invented calculus in spare time. Then turned 26. lots of great tidbits like that throughout the book. And you can have your own copy with a pledge of $180 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Yeah, some of those tweets really cracked me up. In fact, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think you tweeted about how embarrassing it would be should that asteroid destroy Earth and we didn't do anything about it.
Yeah, we'd be the laughingstock of aliens in the galaxy if they learned that we went extinct from an asteroid just the way the dinosaurs did, because we have a space program. I can't even face them if that's the fate of humans on Earth.
Yeah, how embarrassing.
How embarrassing is that?
Yeah, and you're a fan of Twitter,
well,
yes?
Wait, speaking of aliens again, yeah. Another embarrassing moment with an alien. I would just be embarrassed to have to tell an alien lands, I say, you know, we still pull our energy out of fossil fuels beneath the soil of the Earth. You know, that's just embarrassing. I'm sorry.
Where should we get it instead?
The universe is full of energy. Mm-hmm. That's why the people say, I don't worry about up there. Let me look down here on Earth, because I got to solve the problems here on Earth. Like all the solutions to your problems are going to show up here on Earth when there's got this vast universe with unlimited supplies of energy, unlimited resources. And, you know, so it's very... You know, it's like the horse with the blinders on left and right, because they don't want to know what other solutions might be there, because all they care about is what's standing right in front of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, the asteroid might come one day. You want sources of energy? The sun is a boundless source of energy. You need natural resources? We got asteroids with natural resources. The moon is everything out there is a natural resource. It's more of a natural resource than Earth is. So, see, now you got me screaming at you.
Yeah. Do you think that President Obama gets it? Does he get this? Is he an advocate of NASA?
I get mixed signals. Mm-hmm. I was at his NASA speech at Kennedy Space Center, where he said, look, we've been to the moon. Why go back? Let's go to Mars and let's visit asteroids. And he all sounded like he got it. All right. And everyone's cheering, and he always gives a good speech, no matter what, even if he's reading the phone book, mm-hmm. he gives a good speech. And so then afterwards I said, wait a minute, if we're going to skip the moon, then there are all these jobs related to the mission to the moon that would have happened in the near term. And then there is no rocket yet to go to Mars, so there's going to be this gap, this launch gap. And so as a consequence of the simple statement, hey, we've been to the moon, let's go to Mars, tens of thousands of people lost their jobs. That's fact one. Fact two, well, when is your plan for us to get to Mars? Oh, 2030s, something like that. Well, okay. So he's making a promise to be fulfilled by a president to be named later on a budget not yet established. And I thought, well, how easy is that to do? All right, you just say it. And when Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon before the decade is out, essentially he's promising to do that under his watch, had he survived for a second term. And so we happen to live in an era where presidents are promising things far beyond their capacity to shepherd it to completion. That's why such goals have to be a mandate of the electorate and not a mandate of the elected.
Let's take another call from Ben in Merrill. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Well, I'm so glad to talk to Mr. Tyson. I am astounded at some things, the things that you and I have in common as far as our viewpoints. Anyway, my idea, my theory is that the entire Big Bang theory is the exact opposite of what it should be. The universe is measurably accelerating. And if one would just take it backwards and bring it back to a starting point, it would be at a starting point of almost nothing.
But if you turn the clocks back, and so that's in fact, it's the very expansion of the universe that told us. Well, if it's bigger today than yesterday, then it meant it was smaller. If it's bigger tomorrow than today, that meant it was smaller yesterday and the day before and the day before and the day before. And you run the clocks back, you get that the entire universe occupied the same place at the same time 13.7 billion years ago, and we would have been hot and dense. And being hot and dense and small has consequences. And so you run through the physics and the particle physics. This was the marriage of particle physics and cosmology to create a new field called astroparticle physics. This happened in the late 1980s. And because what the astronomers didn't have all the knowledge of what particles would do under those conditions, but the particle physicists didn't really know cosmology. You marry them, and you have a deep understanding of what would have gone on in the early universe, and you make predictions, and you look around the universe, and it's all there, just what you'd expect it to be. So there's very strong evidence for why the Big Bang is an account of our universe and why it's not even controversial. The debates go on about the edges and the details, but not in the core understanding and principle of it.
You were asked by Time magazine recently to describe the most astounding fact about the universe or the most astounding thing about the universe. And it really – your answer really did inspire me, because you mentioned how many of us look into the night sky and we feel small, but you look into the night sky and you feel big. Why?
Well, first of all, thanks for remembering that. They came to my office and asked me 10 questions, and that was like 3 years ago.
Oh, was it?
And they've always been on the internet. But what happened was somebody in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks tops, found that question and then made a YouTube video of it with imagery,
yes,
that matched my commentary. And then it went viral. So it went viral, I mean, for a science video, not
right.
Viral like a Lady Gaga video.
Yeah, right.
So it got 2 million views within just a few days. And I was very charmed by this. These are the efforts of creative producers and videographers and artists. And they value added to my sitting there on my chair talking about the universe, because the reporter asked me, what's the most astonishing fact? And I said, and I made it very clear, it's the fact that our atoms of our body are traceable to the crucibles of manufacturing that goes on in the centers of stars, where they take light elements, fuse them, and make heavy elements. And you start with the lightest element, hydrogen, and they fuse them right on down the periodic table of elements. And in there you get the carbon and the nitrogen and the oxygen and all the elements that make up biochemistry. And these elements are scattered across the universe. And once they're made, when the next time you make a star, that star can now have planets made of these materials. And those planets can have life made of those materials. And so when I look out to the universe, many people feel insignificant or small, but I feel large, because there's a connectivity of my atoms to the rest of the atoms that comprise the cosmos. And that's the theme of that YouTube video.
Yeah. The universe is in us. I thought that was cool.
That phrase is traceable to the whole collaboration of Carl Sagan and Cosmos. And so it's a very powerful concept that has its roots in a 1957 research paper that demonstrated the origin of the elements on the periodic table, showing that they're birthed in the cores of high mass stars. So it's been with us for most of the 20th century.
Andy in Madison is with us now. Hello, Andy.
Hi. It's an honor to be talking to you, Dr. Tyson. And my question is just kind of tangentially related to the theme of frontiers we're having. My question is, along with Sagan and several other figures, you've kind of become one of the unofficial spokesmen of the hive mind of atheism and agnosticism, a kind of new societal frontier as these ideas start to gain more acceptance. How has this affected you? Has it affected you?
Excellent question. So, no, I have no atheist platform. What's happened is I've made some comments that have been rapidly and firmly grabbed by the atheist movement. And so I've been sort of claimed by the atheist movement. But the methods and tactics and I don't it's not how I conduct my public life. I'm an educator, I'm a scientist, and my goal is not to rid people of their religion. My goal is to enlighten people about how the universe works. And so if some of that happens to step on a religious philosophy that you hold, I'm not apologetic for that. But I'm not – I have no platform where I'm trying to change the world of their belief systems. I'm offering a way to think about the world. And if that challenges your belief system, that's okay. But it's not what drives me. And so – so I found a word, the word that best describes me is agnostic, although the more vocal atheists view that as just a cop-out. Mm-hmm. They say all agnostics are atheists. And so – but so I don't really go there. I don't engage in debates, or I try not to at least. And it just doesn't I don't join groups of non-golfers, right? I don't play golf. I'm not in the non-golfer mm-hmm. association. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things I don't do. I don't join organizations to not do them. So the organization of non-believers in God, I just can't. I don't have the energy for that. I don't have the time. I don't have the interest.
Kelly on Facebook writes, "I've spent the past 7 years studying theology, only to decide at the end of it all that it doesn't answer the questions I have. Science will. I'd like to start studying physics at the age of 27." You have any advice for Kelly?
Okay, well, first, there was no lost time for studying theology. Theology is a driving force of so much of the world's conduct, especially when in the history of warfare. So to understand the capacity of the human mind to think in theological ways will give you deep insight into the conduct of nations over the millennia. So don't view that as having wasted time. If you want to get to the heart of what drives the universe, it's physics and math. Math is the language of the universe, no different from if you want to go to China and speak to the natives, learn Chinese. You want to commune with the cosmos, you learn mathematics. And physics is the foundational science of it all. There is no understanding of chemistry without physics, and there is no understanding of biology without chemistry. So your person is thinking exactly the right path if they want deep insights into the operations of nature.
Well, before we let you go, Neil deGrasse Tyson, maybe some parting words for us as we are in this presidential election year, and we're hearing a lot about our economy and the budget and cutting our deficit.
Yeah, I would say that investments in space, you have to think of it not as some handout, not as, oh, we can't afford that now, come back when we have more money. This is the wrong thought. The thought is a half a penny on a dollar. Wow, if that's all it takes to completely reinvest in our urges to dream about tomorrow and to make that tomorrow happen by stimulating a flux of the next generation of students in that educational pipeline to become scientists and engineers. I'm tired of running away from hurricanes. I want to be the person who says, how do we deflect that hurricane or tap the energy of that hurricane and drive the energy needs of the city that the hurricane would otherwise level? Rather than run away from the asteroid, I want to say, how do I deflect that asteroid? What technologies will I need to make that happen? We have an energy crisis. We have jobs going overseas. No, I don't want to put in a tariff to keep the jobs here or tax incentives. I want to innovate in such a way that our factories will be making products that no one else has figured out how to make yet because we are too far ahead of them for having innovated it. Space exploration is a frontier that drives all of this. It's like a flywheel of innovation and inspiration of with a power of, that I've yet to see equaled in any other need or desire of society.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, author of Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Physicians Plus Insurance, offering members a choice in care at UW Health, Meritor Hospital and Clinics, and a network of hospitals and primary care physicians throughout South Central Wisconsin. On the web at pplusic.com.
This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. I'm Joy Cardine with Rob Ferret, hoping if you haven't given yet, now is a good time at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Make your pledge now, and remember, when you pledge $180 or more, you'll get your very own copy of Neil deGrasse Tyson's book, Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier. Just scratch the surface, really. There's right. So much in the book, a lot on the allure of space, the benefits, the case for space travel and research. Also some fun stuff, chapters like how to prove you've been abducted by an alien.
Oh, great.
lots of fun tweets. Anniversary of Apollo 11 and an anniversary of Star Trek. Lots of fun and serious topics in Neil deGrasse Tyson's book. Yours for a pledge of $180 or more. Ask for it with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
An anonymous donor from Somerset says, Wisconsin Public Radio gives me real news and information that I can use for all aspects of my life. I also love science and technology shows. So thank you very much for making a pledge during this past hour when we were talking about science and technology and the importance of our space program to our future economy with Neil deGrasse Tyson. So if you would like to say thanks for having this kind of programming, if you would like Neil's book, all you have to do is pledge $180. It will help pay for Wisconsin Public Radio, and you will pick up a copy of his book, Space Chronicles, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
A pledge for that copy of the book. Pledge because you love Wisconsin Public Radio, and pledge because you appreciate the job Joy Cardine does each and every morning, all the work she puts into preparing for these really diverse topics. Just this morning, dancing, state politics,
right,
and space and beyond. Pledge because you love that diversity of topics, too. Just figure out why you appreciate Wisconsin Public Radio, put a dollar amount on it, and go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Make that pledge now.
If you've been wondering how you can do more for the station that is a big part of your life, you can consider making a donation of $1,200. Listener support is crucial to Wisconsin Public Radio's future. If you would like to do more than you've done before and can afford to make a leadership contribution of $100 a month, do that now. Any gift is appreciated at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This is a worthwhile show, a worthwhile network. You love Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a great part of your life, a part of your day, a part of your Wisconsin community. Show your support now with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We heard from one donor who said, every day Wisconsin Public Radio brightens my mind, raises my spirit, and piques my curiosity. Another said, Wisconsin Public Radio is the best deal ever.
Thanks for those comments. We couldn't have said it any better ourselves. Because you have these same thoughts running through your mind, support WPR right now with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Do it because you do appreciate hearing in-depth conversations about issues and ideas that matter to all of us. You enjoy hearing the latest political news. You enjoy hearing from from the newest authors about new ideas. You enjoy it when we have fun and talk about Wisconsin life and fun things like dancing or food or travel. Do it because you know that Wisconsin Public Radio counts on listener contributions to pay the bills. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your pledge of any amount helps pay for this wonderful programming. And remember, as we go into the news, you can still pledge $180 or more and ask for your copy of Neil deGrasse Tyson's Space Chronicles, Facing the Ultimate Frontier, with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I have to give a shout out to Cynthia Schuster, who produced this program and who has a massive science geek crush on Neil deGrasse Tyson. So thanks, Cynthia, and thanks to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Thank you if you've made a pledge. And remember, you can get a copy of his book, Space Chronicles, for a pledge of $180, WPR.org.